speaking today with Harvard-based Professor Steven Greenblatt, whose historical and imaginative book, Will in the World, is one of our most popular sources for Shakespeare and Stonington. Welcome, Professor Greenblatt, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you, Alicia. Nice to be here.
Great. Listen, I've been reading A Midsummer Night's Dream over and over again in preparation for this production, and the more I read it, the more I get depressed. I came to this play thinking comedy, now I'm thinking fable, now I'm thinking science fiction about marriage. What's going on in this play?
Shouldn't depress you, surely. I mean, but it's the case, I think, probably, that all of Shakespeare's comedies are a little strange. In fact, extremely strange. Most often it's not the presence of the genres you mentioned, but it's the presence of tragedy that people notice in Shakespeare's comedies, the amount of pressure that something dark or disturbing registers in the comedies, especially the early comedies, of which Midsummer Night's Dream is one. You tend to think of them as they are, as festive and joyous. But Shakespeare made the decision, evidently, or in any case, his art makes the decision that the festivity and the joyousness is intensified rather than diminished by the presence of something disturbing.
What do you think some of the anxieties are in this play, some of the tensions?
I mean, they're, for one thing, articulated extremely fully in the play. The first anxiety, obviously, is the premise, the ancient premise. It's not Shakespeare's alone, but it's the source of the, much of the plot of ancient comedy, that your father, could say your parents in general, but there's definitely, in a typical Shakespeare way, there's a father but not a mother here, that your father is going to keep you from marrying the person you want to marry, that you're not going to wind up with the person you actually love. And that anxiety is one that plays out, as I say, everywhere. It's actually the foundation stone of almost all Western European comedy.
Well, what do you think any of the women in this play stand to gain from getting married? I mean, one has a drugged husband, the other one is drugged herself so that her young ward can be taken away from her, the other's wooed by the sword. Why get married if you're a woman?
Alicia, if you ask that question too strenuously, no one will get married. And people recognize that. I mean, of course, in the misogynist culture of the past, they tended to ask the question about men, of men as well as of women, but they also asked it of women. What's the point? What's the point of getting married? It's much better to stay single, and after all, some people did decide to do that, and you had a religious culture that, before Protestantism, that encouraged people to stay single, but the fact is people tend not to do so. Now, if you're asking what's in it, if you're making a kind of rational calculus, well, I mean, that's a tricky question. Sometimes there's something in it, sometimes there isn't. But Shakespeare's comedies, in any case, are based on the idea that people aren't making rational decisions based on cost-benefit analysis. They're making decisions because they're actually desperate to get married, because they're desperately in love, because marriage is the way the culture recognizes what it's like to live with someone you desperately want to live with.
Well, there was at least one person, one woman in Elizabethan England who didn't get married.
That's true.
How do you think Queen Elizabeth saw this play?
I mean, it's certainly the case that Elizabeth didn't get married, in her case, for very pressing strategic reasons. I mean, she played at the marriage game for her whole career. Way, way late by contemporary standards, where she was sort of teasing various possible suitors with the possibility of marriage. But Elizabeth was someone for whom your original question, why on earth would a woman get married, what's in it for her, was certainly the one that she must have asked herself repeatedly. In any case, if she saw the play, and we don't know for sure that she did, though there is internal evidence as well as a pleasant line of speculation that she did, she must have accepted the compliment that was offered her with pleasure. But as for herself, I think that it's probably the case that, at least judging from what contemporaries said, that she herself, at moments in her life, particularly in relation to Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester, felt exactly the kind of frantic desire that Shakespeare comically depicts fits his characters, men and women, as feeling. But she was, in her case, compelled or wise enough, depending how you describe it, to resist this impulse.
Professor Greenblatt, in your book, Will in the World, you don't talk too much about Midsummer Night's Dream, and it left me wondering a little bit about your position on the play. Is it one of your favorites? Where does it stand in your estimation of Shakespeare's works?
I do. I love the play. I think I do say, I don't have the book in front of me, but I have at least a sort of fantasy that Shakespeare was taken to see the marvelous celebrations for Elizabeth that Leicester had organized not so far away from Stratford, and that out of that experience as a young boy, Shakespeare could have generated some of the magical effects of Midsummer Night's Dream. I think that the play builds out of many things. It's an unusual play in Shakespeare's part because he didn't steal it wholesale from somebody else. He stole only little bits of it from here and there. And one of the bits that he obviously uses, stitches together to make his amazing creation, is the kind of mythological festivities done for monarchs, complete with, as you actually watch people frantically and somewhat ineptly, extremely ineptly, try to entertain the ruler. I think he was amused by that effort. But anyway, I think that what's strange about Midsummer Night's Dream, I mean, it's actually, again, it goes along with the strangeness in general of Shakespeare. Here's the play that actually, if you are teaching lively elementary school children, you might think of having them act out some of Midsummer Night's Dream. After all, it's got fairies and zany comedy of various kinds, and people do that routinely. But it's also, of course, the play, as we've started by saying, haunted by compulsion and death, threat of death, also eerily haunted by this extremely strange representation of what looks like bestiality, anxiety about moles and hair lips and scars, strange thoughts about love juice and erotic compulsion. So you, in a way that it took Freud really in the late 19th century to get us back to the fact that if this is a child's play, it's a child's play filled with remarkable compulsive fantasies that we associate, as I say, with unchained libidinal energy.
I've been trying to think of corollaries in contemporary culture, and I've been thinking a little bit about Harry Potter, but what you've just said makes me think about the new Pixar films, which combine childlike themes with adult-like undertones.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I hadn't actually made that connection, but I think it's absolutely true that actually Shakespeare managed to carry off something that now contemporary artists do, at least they try to do, which is to figure out ways of getting a quite young audience to take delight in what they're offering, paying for, but at the same time amuse extremely sophisticated audiences as well. And indeed, there is a current of thought and academic thought, as you may know, that thinks that Midsummer Night's Dream is one of Shakespeare's most philosophical plays, that it hides in itself a set of very deep reflections on the nature of fantasy and the imagination, driven by long philosophical meditations on Platonic themes. I don't know whether that's true or not, but there is a current of thought in the Academy that thinks that. And the fact that it exists at all in connection with Midsummer Night's Dream is interesting, because it's also, as I say, the one that you expect to see, 7-year-old girls in tutus performing.
Is there a particular character in Midsummer Night's Dream who captures your imagination the most?
I mean, I predictably like the one whom probably everyone likes, Bully Bottom. That is to say, the one who simultaneously is the most spectacular horse's ass in the play, and at the same time who has the vision that comes closest, in fact, to the religious or philosophical vision that some people see in the play, in those lines that he parodies, of inadvertently parodies, from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, where he sees something that can't be heard, and he hears something that can't be seen, or whatever. However he jumbles it. That is to say, he's the only one in the world that, full of people who think that they see very clearly and don't really understand anything. He's the one who has this astonishing vision that he wants to finally make into a song called Bottom's Dream, because it's bottomless.
And before we say goodbye to you, could you tell us how you yourself came to know and love Shakespeare's works?
I came to know and love... Did I come and love... First, I'm trying to think, Alicia, if I came to know and love him through Midsummer Night's Dream. I don't think so. I must have come fairly late. In fact, my first memories of Midsummer Night's Dream are to the famous Peter Brook production on the trapezes that still stays with me as one of the most astonishing things I've ever seen. But I must have come first. I did come first to love Shakespeare in a rather unlikely way through a high school class on King Lear and King Lear alone. It must have been a very strange high school decision on a high school teacher's part to teach a bunch of 16-year-olds King Lear in the course of a whole semester, and I was astonished by it, and still actually can get a kind of strange chill when I think about what went on in that experience, which was largely the experience of encountering something so complex and so deep that I recognized I could not even begin to understand it. And it's that feeling, at the same time that I was moved by it, it's that feeling that, I suppose that's why I'm an academic, you're driven then to try to figure out what on earth that was about. But there are lots of ways of loving Shakespeare, and I think that probably was the way I started.
That's great. Professor Greenblatt, thank you for sharing your thoughts and your expertise and your time with us, and we hope to see you sometime at a Shakespeare play.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.